Howdy, folks. Welcome to another episode of DevOps Diaries. Oh my goodness. there is so much to bring you in this episode. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to Laurel Jones, a senior product manager at Amazon Air. We talk about the difficulties of deploying communities. We talk about the amazing things that can be achieved through design thinking. We talk about the fantastic initiatives that Amazon Air have run for empowering women in technology and the impact that Laurel has had on those programs. This is an absolute treat for the ears, and I can't wait to bring this to you today. Thank you for listening, and make sure you listen right to the end. There are some great insights over the next hour or so that Laurel has been able to provide us with. Thank you for tuning in, as always, to the DevOps Diaries podcast. I'm your host, Jack McCarty, and enjoy. Hey, Laurel, thank you so much for joining us on the DevOps Diaries podcast today.
Yeah, happy to be here. Thank you.
Yes. Laurel, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on. I've been really looking forward to having a chat with you and having the listeners be able to learn from your experiences, especially as you are one of the current and have been for this year one of Gearset's DevOps leaders. What has that experience been like for you working with Gearset?
Yeah, it was kind of an honor to be nominated and to get the leadership position. My first experience of being one was going to DevOps Dreamin' in Chicago this year. That was, I think, back in March. And I got to meet all the other DevOps leaders from across different industries and different companies, like various sizes too, of companies. So it was good to hear their perspectives and kind of hear where and be able to sit down with you know the creator of Gearset to be able to sit down and like actually give him feedback and have him take that into account, right? So I think that the personal nature of it, the ability to kind of bridge the customer to the developer VP is really huge to be able to kind of give that feedback. And myself from Amazon, but I also have a consulting background, and I have worked at smaller companies, and so I kind of understand where those perspectives were coming from, and to be able to share that directly with, you know, leadership is a huge deal. I've also been a huge proponent of Gearset here at Amazon. I'll be honest, I hadn't actually used Gearset prior to like 2019, I think. And so I know, like, again, as a consultant, I was using it if my client used it, right? Otherwise, mm-hmm. I was just using change sets, and it was super annoying, right? so to be able to have build a project in sandboxes and then have to move them manually via change sets and tell the customer, you have to wait because I have to do this. But then when I moved into Amazon, one of the first things we did was like, we need Gearset because this change sets is not going to work. And so we got the approval to buy a couple licenses, and it was game over from there. It was like, we're not doing anything else. So I've been, and lots of people have here at Amazon have been asking me a lot about it and how we've used it, how we like it. And I'm just a huge advocate and a champion for it there. So I'll kind of sit down with them for 30 minutes or so and kind of walk them through how we use it. You know, the interactions and the personal nature that a lot of the account team has had with us. And you don't find that in a lot of kind of ISVs or companies that are tangential to Salesforce. They often have a lot of, I guess, hesitation, or there's like a barrier between customer and company. So Gearset just is the exact opposite of that. And I've really appreciated that. So I love being a leader so that I can champion the product.
Yeah, well, it's an absolute pleasure to have that insight. And I think for any ISV, Gearset or otherwise, that feedback from the community and the users is super empowering.
Totally.
That really, like, it, being in it and having that experience and taking real world stories, because we build a product and we hope that it gets used, and, you know, we hope that it's solving the problems that the product's been designed for. It's just having that actual tangible feedback from folks like yourself that are experienced in DevOps or whatever an ISV is looking mm-hmm. at solving, and those challenges is super powerful. Also helps when you get nice swag, like that nice North Face Gearset leadership that you're wearing right now.
Super comfy, and it's super cold here, so it's perfect.
Yeah. So for the listeners, tell us a little bit about your experience with, so you mentioned your consulting background using change sets, obviously a pain. A lot of us are familiar with that, wrestling, grappling with change management in general. Tell us a little bit about the DevOps experience that you have and that kind of journey that you've been on that's allowed you to embrace best practices and utilizing a platform like Gearset.
Yeah, sure. So like I said, so Gearset, my first introduction to Gearset was in about 2019, but prior to that, I'd been a consultant, probably since the start of, like the 2010s ish. And so I had actually made the transition because I was in a company that was taken over or acquired by another company, and they used Salesforce as the CRM to kind of blend the two companies, to bring all of our processes together. And I really enjoyed working with the team. I think there was a consultancy in Canada or something that we were working with, and I really enjoyed working and seeing how their process was and getting the user feedback and seeing that. And so that actually, lo and behold, the company that got acquired was kind of laying off everybody of the company that they acquired, because that naturally happens. And so I ended up looking for a new role, and I found a consulting role that was for Salesforce, but it was specific to UI and kind of marketing and things like that. But I was getting in more into the Salesforce realm. But in that, I learned a lot about the... like the DevOps process, because I had to learn Salesforce from scratch. And so in moving, it started out little things, right? Like fields or page layouts, right? And those are pretty easy without any dependencies. You're just gathering up, you know, three or four pieces of metadata and sending it. But as I grew in my career in consulting and the projects got bigger and bigger, it ended up taking at least an entire day sometimes to deploy something. Wow. And then it would depend on the client too, right? Whether they, what kind of DevOps process they had, if any at all, if they used any tools like GitHub, or if they had change management reviews. There was a lot of just kind of variability. And so you kind of almost hoped sometimes they didn't have that structure, because it's just like, we just need to get this through, you know, and they're like, oh, well, these are dependencies. And it's like, oh, you know, so you're cursing the skies. And it was painful. And so you kind of found those little workarounds, like, oh, well, this is a manual update anyway, so I'm just going to go over here and do this anyway. While I'm here, I'll just add this button, because that's going to take me 2 seconds. So it ended up kind of being a blend of using change sets, but also kind of doing a lot of the manual updates that are like super quick that you just know as an admin. So, just entire days were wasted. I probably have spent an entire year wasted on non-change sets over the course of my career. That might be exaggerated, but it feels like
I'm not sure that it is.
Yeah. But regardless, and then when I started to, you know, within the last probably decade or so, started to work with companies that were larger and had better change management and better DevOps processes, I started to kind of pick up on what worked really well, and how to then take that process and work backwards from that, to where you have to, if this is the bar that you need to meet, then you need to do these things to get there. So it was a lot of capturing everything I was working on, whether it was a field or a validation rule or like custom metadata or whatever. I would capture it, and I'd have these huge spreadsheets of like the label name, the API name, whether it was going to be manually updated. Like I would just do that manually, and that would make things go smoother. But obviously the development time increased there too, because I'd have to capture all of that. So then using Gearset, you know, here in the recent years, I was finding like I was relatively new to it, so I had to learn it too. But then I realized like it's figuring all this out for me. Like it notes everything that I've changed and everything that's new, and so all I have to do is just go click and send it. Like that's it. So I was over the moon. I was like, why haven't I been using this sooner? So, and again, it just kind of came back to the fact that I was like, well, my client doesn't, and so we can't. But it was definitely a big selling point for me when I was I was hired as a solution architect. So I was consulting, And I was hired as a solution architect at Amazon Air to stand up a Salesforce instance for them. And that was one of the first things we did. I think we did one or two deployments and change sets, and we're like, nope, this is Gearset. So by month three, we were already getting licenses and using Gearset. And it was just, we improved, I think, our time. So instead of an entire day dedicated to deployment, we narrowed it down to, I think, an hour. Like of those size, it was insane. And we were like, what do we do with all this time? So then we started to think about how we would actually improve the process. And again, kind of working backwards from what we know we have to get to deploy, kind of keeping track and making sure that we're tracking all of those components that we're deploying.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So you mentioned a couple of times there, just right at the end that you were speaking, figuring out the process, like what works. And you mentioned it. As you started talking about your experience then, is there anything that you've identified that does repeatedly work? You know, you said you figure out what works and what doesn't work. Is there anything that's kind of been universal across the projects that you've worked on in terms of this works really well, we can repeat this and this will scale across other projects or with other clients that I've worked with? Or is it truly a no one size fits all to some of this?
Yeah. I would say the specifically in Gearset, the filters, the ability for us to know that we only check certain pieces of metadata to be able to filter that down and lessen the time to do the review between the target and the source sandboxes. That's been huge because we use Salesforce here at Air very uniquely. It's pretty much all custom. We do use, you know, accounts, contacts, some of the standard objects. But we have very, very specific functionality. And so to narrow even, you know, the small minute amount of time that we spend in DevOps, those things add up over time. So all of the little convenience things that kind of make it to where, you know, if we're working with, because we have consultants as well that we work with, if we sit down with them and say, hey, you have these projects, I see that you have these custom metadata, they're in this package, do the filter, and it's done in 5 minutes. So otherwise, you know, just using everything, it's just kind of knowing your org, knowing what you're working on and being able to, understand, where the targets are, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of knowing what's in your org and the specificity of the metadata that you're working with, you're something of a subject matter expert for communities. Or what is now known as digital experiences.
Yeah.
you know, Salesforce name changes. It'll be something else next week.
Yeah.
Communities. I'm going to do it. I'm going to keep calling them communities because that's about
how my brain's. Let's just call it communities. Yeah.
communities are known for sometimes being somewhat challenging to deploy and work with.
Yes.
What can folks that are working with communities do to streamline that experience? Maybe aside from using Gearset, using Gearset is great. Sometimes folks don't always have that opportunity to do that. But what are some of the main considerations when deploying communities and working with communities generally, especially as it pertains to security? There's been a couple of instances this year where communities have been the source of data leaks I'm talking like banking and healthcare companies as well. So it's great that companies are looking to extend their digital transformation and give their customers a better experience through communities. But what are some of the things that we need to consider when working with communities generally and then deploying that to users and to be used?
Communities are very tricky and definitely high risk. One of the first things I do when I stand up a community is figure out who the users are and what they need access to, even on a granular level. Because that's really the key where, for example, we have a community and it reaches, I think, four different, external partner types. So they all require very specific business processes and very explicit access to records. So we make sure that any new partner we're adding has the exact permission sets, the profile, like whole security model, right? Profile, role, say, license, permission sets, sharing sets, everything is exactly as it should be. And then we document that. That's a big piece too, so that any new member or a consultant coming onto the team is able to look at that and say, okay, well, I know this is the persona. They have access to this, this, and this. Here's how I go and set them up. Because again, that it comes back to accountability and being able to say, okay, well, I covered my bases so that we are only granting X functionality to these personas. So security model is super important. I think that's the starting point of any community. The sharing sets too are a bit limiting. I wish they were a little bit more granular. Like we could have what we do for Salesforce licensed users, for customer portal users. They're really just account based. So the user that's attached to a contact that's attached to an account is kind of how the thread works. So anything that is attached to that account then can have access to these objects, whatever. So it's a little tricky. And I don't think those are deployable either. I'll be honest, I'll caveat all this with there may have been changes that I haven't seen in the security model. So I'm willing to put my foot in my mouth here, but and I hope somebody reaches out to me and says, hey, Laurel, did you know? Because I'd love to understand that. But I don't think those are deployable either. So it's all very manual, which any manual task is open and rife for mistakes. So anywhere where we can start to automate that is good. And so coming back to that conversation I was telling you about where, you know, we sat down with Matt and in the DevOps and, you know, we're sharing some of the feedback. One of my pieces was we need to be able to deploy communities through Gearset or because it you can technically do it, but it's very, very piecemeal. And there's a ton of manual effort after it. So you can deploy a brand new community into a brand new org, but you can't easily deploy an existing community from a sandbox into an existing community in an org. It makes it very difficult, especially like where you have potentially conflicts in like pages that you've created or objects or security model, right? Like anything will throw it off. It's very sensitive. So I've ended up taking the approach with communities where I'm just manually deploying everything, which makes it incredibly time consuming. So I'll give you an example. I was working with a client on the East Coast and they we built, you know, the initial community and we deployed it without a problem because it was brand new. It was great. And then we ended up creating probably close to 20 to 30 pages. So detail pages, custom pages, lots of audiences and page variations. And so it was a lot of complexity of like who can see what and like what page they should see and what record layout they should see. So there's a lot of interesting nuance to it. I had to end up manually recreating that. So I had UAT up in one screen and then prod up in the other and was just going one by one and assigning like the audiences and making sure those were correct. Again, if someone wants to tell me that those are deployable, please, because I will do it tomorrow. But that's pretty much the process that I've taken so far is just the manual workaround. I think what Matt had told us was that there's some complexity to how it, like the fact that it kind of sits on top of and is not really truly integrated with is a little difficult to reach from a DevOps perspective or from like a gear set, a tool perspective. So I don't know if that's changed, but I would be glad to put my foot in my mouth there. Eat my words, I guess is probably a better word. It's been a nightmare. So any changes, even today, we're doing it manually.
Yeah. I guess the key question is, with all the effort that is required in standing up communities, deploying communities, how do you make sure that all that time and effort is worth it?
That's an interesting question. I don't know if it's worth it in that it has to get done. For example, if, and I'll, if we have a new object that we stand up for a new business purpose, then we obviously within the community, we have to create maybe some audiences, maybe definitely some object pages, and make sure that we have the right layouts on them and everything. So I think it's more just making sure that that transition happens into the target sandbox, or sorry, either target sandbox or production. So there's a lot of accountability that's required from the person doing that, person on team who's doing that, to be able to say, like, we write this down, we write these steps down. And that was actually something that we wrote into our DevOps process. Is we added in our project management tool, we added some custom fields where we capture the solution components for that story, and we also have the pre and post deployment steps captured as well, so that the DevOps leader, the person on our team who kind of manages the deployments, so that she understands, like, what do I need to do, and what are those post-deployment steps, and how long is this going to take? Mm-hmm. And then we started to add in kind of the business impact, and do we have the knowledge article updated, and do we have, are we able to justify what would happen, or sorry, not justify, how what we would do to mitigate if something went wrong? So, like, we're really starting to more critically think about the impact that change will make, and what would happen if something did go wrong. Like, if we forgot a page duration, we forgot an audience, what would happen? So I don't know if it's I don't know about worth necessarily, but it's more, again, just kind of CYA and cover your butt. I'm not sure if we can cuss on this, but CYB. but
cover your ass. I'll say it for you.
thank you. So it's CYA, making sure that we have everything in place, like, just in case something does go wrong, that we have that immediate rollback. And Gearset has that as well, right? Just like that automatic rollback, which is super great.
Yeah.
Hello. I hope you are enjoying this episode so far. And the insight that Laurel is providing is giving you some great food for thought. With that in mind, and that food for thought, I thought I would let you know about how you can make your January that little more bearable. We at Gearset are giving you the opportunity to win an $1,000 Amazon gift card for you to spend how you choose. All you have to do is submit your responses to the State of Salesforce DevOps survey. A link to that survey will be in the episode description, where you can share with us how your DevOps plans are shaping up for the year and where your team is currently sitting. With that in mind, I hope you enjoy the next section of the podcast, where we look to dive into some automation and CI/CD and streamlining processes, which will hopefully give you more food for thought about where you are right now and what you're looking to achieve. So go ahead and click that link in the description. The State of Salesforce DevOps survey is now live, and good luck in the Amazon gift card draw. Thank you very much. Back to the episode.
Something that we've spoken about in our brief conversations that we've had is you look at a lot of your processes and look at how you become more agile and how you mm-hmm. look to speed up delivery to your users. And a core proponent of that is obviously CI/CD. What does the journey towards CI/CD look like for you right now?
Yeah, that's something we're going to actively look into next year. we tried this year. Unfortunately, just for our business use cases, pipelines for Gearset didn't work for us at the time. But I think there's been some changes that will make it work for us. So we're going to look into implementing that, because I feel like that would expedite a lot of time and energy, and just more granular level deployments and getting things out quicker. I know I've seen it in a lot of our customers, because as the product manager, I'm kind of the face of the product, of the tool, to make sure that my customers' needs are met. And so I've seen that frustration with them to say, okay, well, you're starting your sprint. When is it going to be deployed? Oh, 2 weeks later. And that's 2 weeks is a long time here in Aaron. We move the speed of light. So we need, if there are small things like, hey, I just need a field updated, or I need something added to a pick list value, like something super small, it takes 2 seconds to do. You still have to, there's a lot of that CYA, right? And that's maybe couple hours of just making sure we documented the everything's updated accordingly. You know, we've got everything covered, but you know, the actual action is going to take 2 seconds. You go in and you add a pick list value, right? But it's the testing, it's the impact analysis, it's all of this. And I think even with all of that, if we could take, let's just stick with that pick list value example, that would take, let's say, 2 hours worth of work with everything combined in it, but we're not going to deploy it for 2 weeks. Doesn't make sense. Mm. So I'd love to get to the point where we can do those smaller changes and just push them through without issue. The other complexity of within Amazon, obviously we are in peak period within Amazon. You know, y'all are shopping like crazy.
We're recording this just after Thanksgiving and just before Christmas. If you're listening to this at another time, this is just before the Christmas rush, everybody, for a bit of context.
Yes. We just had Black Friday. We just had Cyber Monday. So lots of good deals out there. And people have been taking advantage of that. And so typically, and that happens year over year, right? But between November and December is our peak time, and we have code freeze. Like, it is next to impossible to get anything out into production, or a production level organization to where, sorry, I just had to dismiss something. It's impossible to get everything out into a production level system because we don't want to disrupt anything, because my customer is the folks on the ground who are handling those packages. And so if their tools go down, then it's game over. So they're going to be, you know, it could end up in rolled packages where, you know, it misses a flight or it misses a truck. And so we want to make sure that our systems are maintained. And so there's a very strict process, what we call CMBR, Change Management Business Review, where, you know, everything has gone through, you know, strict level review. If it's not like super severe, if there's a workaround, it's not going through. So that's something else we have to take into consideration, is that during those times, and we have those, you know, at various points throughout the year too, like you all are familiar with Prime Day, you know, during July, or Prime Big Deals Day that recently happened as well. So those periods, you know, where we know there's going to be a lot of volume, we lock down our systems to make sure that they're stable. So we have to kind of work around those. That's where CI/CD, I think, might get kind of paused. Like, we'd have to kind of quote unquote turn it off. Other than that, I'm really looking forward to using some tool like that, or some mechanism like that, that Gearset could offer, like pipelines, to where we can just, you know, make our customers instantly happy.
Yeah, absolutely. That business risk. Risk thing, mitigation of risk is obviously the highest. Like, Amazon is probably a very extreme example. In that kind of the way that Amazon operates, and obviously people need their gifts for Christmas, you know, like, there's going to be a lot of unhappy people if something breaks on your side that impacts that. So risk is always something that needs managed, and 100%. If that is the sensible thing to code freeze and make sure that things don't break, then, you know, I think that prior planning throughout the year, so say, okay, we want to make these improvements. How do we make these improvements? We can still have XYZ process up until this point. We're still not going to deploy anything in November and December, just in case. However, we've got a process that works, and when that time does come that we can properly release these changes, you know, that's, we've worked on things that can then be deployed, and we know that can be deployed safely. That's really interesting. Something else that I wanted to touch on as well is, you have a background in UI and UX design. How has that shaped what you do for Amazon, or for your clients back when you were at Slalom? And what part, it's becoming a big thing now. It's a bigger and bigger thing than it ever was when I entered the Salesforce ecosystem 5 years ago. Nobody really talked about UI and UX at all. And now it's getting talked about a lot. What's the future of UI and UX on the platform?
That's a good question. And you're right. I've seen this flood of everyone focusing on, I mean, there's a UX certification. A member of my team actually just got that last week, where it's blown up. And I'm like, where was this 10 years ago? Right.
Yeah. Right.
Because I so my background, I actually have a visual communications degree from an art school. And here I am working in the tech world, which is kind of an interesting perspective. But so I ended up starting my career a lot in like web design and graphic design and like branding and collateral and marketing departments and things like that, where I was doing a lot of, you know, just that branding, building collaterals, working on trade show materials, things like that. And so then I ended up, I really enjoyed using both sides of my brain with that, though, because especially when I moved into consulting, because then I could take the logic and the structure of Salesforce and try to fit UI UX in it, like how that worked together. So in Salesforce at the time didn't have communities. It was just Visualforce, you know, portals and things like that. So it was a lot of taking, you know, frameworks like Bootstrap. This was before Salesforce Lightning Design System. So I was taking like Bootstrap and JavaScript libraries and things like that to pull into the UI for the partner portals, and was making some really unique, UIs. And so I would take my experience in web and graphic design, but then apply it to the constraints within Salesforce. Like, oh, well, that won't necessarily work because Apex won't let us, or the Visualforce framework necessarily won't work with this particular JavaScript library or whatever it was. So we have to kind of be, it forced you to be creative in how you built that user experience. And so it was, I think that added some value to the work that I did as a consultant, where I was able to not only provide the partner portal or the customer portal or whatever they needed, which could just be generic and boring and, you know, here's some forms and here's the navigation, but I took into account their branding, their colors, their buttons, their, any of their brand guidelines. That was one of the first things I always asked for, was just like pulling all of that in so I could make it their own. And then when communities came out, that was a really cool, interesting way to use kind of a CMS almost, because I was familiar with, I'd done some freelance with building like WordPress websites, which are super templatized, right? Like it's all kind of open source, which is super easy. And that kind of reminded me of the start of what communities were, to where you could kind of, you could play around a little bit and quote unquote hack the code and get into and change some of the structure and how things worked. And like, maybe you didn't really like how the buttons looked, so you wanted to change that and you want to change the color of the gradient. So really just kind of finding ways to make it unique to my customer was helpful. And then when it moved into communities, which is very WYSIWYG, again, I took the opportunity to dive a little bit deeper there, even though it was something that was just like out of the box. You could just slap some components on a page and it would look pretty good. Yeah. I would go above and beyond and build those templates, right? Like the community framework. So it would have a custom navigation, it would have a custom header and footer, and we would be applying the customer's branding guidelines. And sometimes they would even provide their own CSS, their style sheets and their JavaScript libraries and things like that that we could use, which was even cooler because then we could actually start to use some of their animations that you would see on their website. So we would even, the transition that they wanted, right, from their something.com to something.com/support in the community portal was seamless. Like just the branding experience, that it was not jarring to go to another website. So that was fun. And then I think as I've matured more into, kind of stepped away a little bit more from the configuration, moved into kind of product management, which, is more customer facing, but more just kind of making sure that I know my customer inside and out, and I know exactly what they need and I know what works for them. That's been kind of taking that experience and kind of pivoting it less on how it looks and more on how it reacts, how intuitive it is. So I've kind of migrated into like, people on the ground, people at these aircraft gateways, handling the packages, taking them off the planes, putting them on a sorter, getting them out on a truck. They don't have time to stare at a screen or do administration. So I always try to keep that in the back of my mind. Like when I'm building tools, is this going to be readable to them? Does this make sense? Is this at a glance what they need to know? Trying to grab their time is so like, what's the word I'm looking for? It's very, they don't have a lot of time. to do anything. So, but they are asked to do follow-up reporting. It's more kind of like bridging gaps that happened. So anything where I can try to automate that as much as possible, given that the data that we have, like, oh, we know something arrived late, or we know that this package was different, then give them that opportunity and just ask them for the why, because that's the only thing we don't have, right? Is what happened, right? Like we know something missed, but the reason we want to know is so that we can improve upon it, and we can learn the lesson, and we don't do it again. So it's trying to do those, what we call five whys, is like, okay, why did you do that? All right, why did you do that? Why did that happen? Right? So it's kind of really digging into the details. And so, while I don't love five whys, it's a lot of administration. It is a good concept, right? It's just more of a lesson learned type of thing. So, like I said, just transitioning, I think, from more of the pretty things to the how does this actually work? How is this helping our customer has been really helpful in building the tools that we need for my customers.
That's awesome. Yeah, that's that deep. How much? There's a lot of folks that I speak to, platform owners, product owners like yourself, and the key thing that they focus on is one of the things that I've heard done a bit is I'm going to go and sit with my users and understand their job like day to day, and that will help me inform how I build a solution or what Salesforce needs to look like and the product or the application that we're building needs to look like. How do you do that at Air? Because I imagine you can't go and sit at a gateway and follow these folks around for security reasons or this, that, and the other. How do you make sure that you do understand, because you touched on it there, they don't have a lot of time. They need, all we need to do is the why. How do you understand your users in an environment like Amazon Air where that FaceTime and connection to the business isn't as easily available as it is, say, at a software company where you're helping a sales team?
Yeah. That was one of the bigger transitions I had to make from consultant to product manager, from, you know, consultant to Amazon, basically, was the shift in, because with the companies I was working with before, were all over the world. They were all over the world, all over the country. I didn't really travel to them, maybe except for like a discovery session, like to sit down with everybody in the room and just kind of hash out what needs to happen, what the problems are. But with Amazon, you're right. There's a ton of, we have, I think, close to 50 different gateways across the US. And so one of the things that I commit to every year is once a quarter, I will go out to one of our bigger sites to see what's going on, how it operates, all the people, the hustle and the bustle, like how, you know, what I'm building can help them or what they need help with so that I can build. So that's something I do is I go out there for a week. I spend a day on the floor, and just kind of watch, and I interview and I kind of grab people beside, I'll kind of like shadow them. I was like, why are you doing that? Or what would make that better? Or, hey, I see you're using this tool and you're not using it effectively. Like, why would you, you know, just kind of diving into their experience, the user experience. And then I'll go to the smaller sites too, because it's very similar concept to Gearset, right? Where you have these big enterprise companies, but you also have, you know, one or two mom and pop shops too. So it's like, how do you build those tools to blend the two worlds, right? To give everybody what they need, but not too much or not too little. So it's very much a Goldilocks story of, you know, and then taking that into account with like priorities, like what is going to impact the most users versus, just, you know, just 3Ps or just, you know, the bigger sites. So like I said, I think the biggest piece to me is just committing to getting out on the floor. And like, I live in Seattle, I'll go to the Seattle site, I will fly over to one of our biggest hubs, which is in Cincinnati. You know, on, you know, maybe twice a year, and then I'll go to a couple other sites around the country. But those are hugely helpful in helping me understand like who's actually using the tool, what the feedback is. And honestly, I get better feedback when I'm face to face with somebody, because I'll get more candid feedback face to face versus over the phone or like on a conference call. Because I'm like, yeah, it's a great tool, I'll use it all the time. But it's like, that they just kind of want to get off the call. They're there to just, you know, say their piece and move it on. But to have that time face to face with somebody, then I can actually dive into, okay, well, you know what, hit me. Like, what is it that you don't like about the product? What is it that could help? That is really helpful. So being in person has been great.
Yeah, absolutely. Something that I wanted to talk to you about as well, working in air transportation is arguably a male dominated industry. And The people that you work with, they're very predominantly male, but you're a DEI leader. Tell me a little bit about your experience being a DEI leader at Amazon and in the wider Salesforce community.
Yeah. So I've always been a champion for women in tech. And then I had never been in the transportation industry up until 3 years ago when I joined Amazon. So I had nothing, no knowledge there, but I was always a big advocate for that and seeing, cause I worked a lot with a lot of males in my career. Not to say that they're bad necessarily, but, it was just, you know, I had challenges trying to get across my expertise because I was a woman, in a room full of men. So, in my consulting days, recently in Slalom, I started to, become leaders in affinity groups or, DEI groups, or, you know, people call them, companies that call them different things, but, where I would help, you know, bring families together. In Slalom, there was a family affinity group. I think it was like Slalom at Affinity or Slalom Families or something. And so we would do a lot of charity work. We would do events to raise awareness about either women in tech or women in consulting, or, you know, what are those challenges that we need to overcome. And I brought that into Amazon as well. That was one of the, when I got hired, it was one of the first things that came on my inbox was an invitation for recruiting for a new affinity group called Women at Air. I was like, oh yes, like this is happening. I have to get on this board. So I applied and I ended up becoming the tech VP, which basically means I just stood up the wiki. I managed a lot of the distro lists and, you know, anything remotely techy was my job. I took my UI UX background in branding and then built a brand around it, right? Like I built some collateral and some like a logo and lots of different graphics that could be used across the different like emails and wikis and documentation and posters and swag, whatever. So that's been kind of fun to kind of scratch that itch while also helping a little bit. But As I grew into the role, I became a VP and then eventually president, as I am now. And I've been noticing the impact that our group has made, to where we focused on three specific pillars: allyship, networking, and development. Allyship is huge, especially within this male-dominated industry, right? Where we know there are allies out there in our male counterparts where they understand and they see it. And maybe they even, they either report to, or they have reporting to them, women that are struggling. And so they see it, and they want to help, but maybe they just don't know how or the best way of approaching it. So that's where the allyship pillar is really focused on making sure that, they're educated. Our allies are educated that you're with us and not against us. Mm-hmm. And we had one of the big goals for last year was to increase our allyship pledge. So there's a particular pledge that somebody can take to say, you know, I am willing to be an ally and I'm willing to call out where there's discrimination in women in this area, and I'm willing to stand up and say and have that conversation, those hard conversations, if I do something wrong, because I want to improve myself. So that's kind of the pledge, and we had a huge increase in signups and pledges on that too. And I mean, sometimes that can be a little lip service, but still, that's huge to be able to see within the org that everybody's committed to this, or, you know, the majority is committed. And so, and then you have networking, which is huge within air because there's so many different components of managing an air operation. You think maintenance of the aircraft, right? Like that's huge. That has to be handled. The service performance, so making sure that everything is flying on time and is flying effectively, that packages are getting to where they need to go quickly. And then there's the, you know, the management of all of our vendors, and then the just operations performance, and then there's safety, of course, and then HR. So there's all these different components, right? And maybe somebody in safety wants to learn a little bit more about maintenance. So then there's that opportunity to bring the two worlds together and have these events where we'll have mixers, we'll have happy hours, but it's more than that. We'll also send them out to industry conferences as well, like women in aviation conferences, to where they can kind of expand their world a little bit. So we'll give those opportunities to folks who maybe wouldn't have that opportunity normally. And so we'll get them to kind of build their network, because that's a huge part of growing in your career, is knowing the right people and being able to make those connections. So then the last part of that is development, where we want to make sure that not only are you growing your network and you're making sure that you have the support underneath you, but also growing you. So what is it that you want to learn? What is it you want to know? There's a lot of documentation about how to build your resume, how to write a follow-up email, like what are a lot of just kind of career growth opportunities. And we have this library of books in aviation on women struggling, things like that, right? So we're just kind of bringing those pieces together and trying to grow the women in air to where they can feel confident and comfortable to grow. Because one of our goals is to see a lot more women in those leadership positions within Amazon. And so to do that, those are the three pillars we thought we needed to focus on the most, to really focus the energy on making sure that we get that goal, right? Like where everybody can be promoted because they have that career growth, they have that network and the support they need.
Yeah, absolutely. That's fantastic. And what have you seen as a result of standing up these pillars and really advocating for women in air and your environment?
Huge success. We've had a lot of, we haven't had a huge amount of promotions, unfortunately. That I think will happen over time. We just started this allyship, the three pillar thing last year. So we built our 3-year plan effectively. So we're kind of looking forward on that one. But the VP of Amazon Air came to us and joined us in our end of year summit a couple of weeks ago, and said, you know, this is one of the affinity groups that has stuck around and been incredibly successful. There's a lot of kind of different, you know, not women focused, but maybe they're other DEI focus. They've always just kind of, you know, been stood up and done a couple networking events and then just kind of fizzled out. But I attribute this a lot to the leadership that we have within the affinity group, that we are just tenacious and we are just going after it. We know this is going to make an impact and we have to get it done because we want to make this, you know, successful for all the women in air. So we've had this same core of leadership over the last couple of years, and we've just seen that grow exponentially. And we actually just doubled our budget for next year. So huge success and huge win there. But excuse me. But to have that feedback from the VP too, where he was saying, you know, we're at it, like keep going. He wants to see it. He's been our biggest ally too, since we even stood it up. And this was before he was VP. He was a huge ally for us and champion, and making sure that, you know, we had the right awareness driving, because it's very hard for us at kind of a, you know, anywhere from junior to senior management ish level, to push these initiatives up. It's very difficult, but then if we get the allies on the leadership level and push down, then we can start to see that impact, right? So it was very important for us at the start to find those, you know, those leaders at those upper levels to be our champions and to kind of communicate and help drive our initiatives. So that was really important for us. And that's been, I think, one of the key factors in our success too.
Yeah, that's incredible. And I'd tip my virtual hat off to those leaders and those executives and those allies that are supporting that. For anybody listening, I think that's an important lesson as well. You mentioned your VP said that some of those other groups have kind of fallen away and what have you. I think for me, the lesson there, and I guess it's something in life as well, is if you believe in something and you want to see change, is like just grab it and drive it. You know, change doesn't happen without those advocates and those people that will continuously drive that mission. I think it's whether it's DEI or whether it's advocating for something that you're passionate about, UX or security or whatever it is in a slightly more technical facet. A lot of folks will sit there and think this is a good idea and I want this, but they don't take it by the reins and really push it forward. And I think that's this is an excellent example of what the results that you can achieve if you do that and you go at it with everything that you have. But that's an amazing story.
Thank you,
Laurel. Thank you so much for coming on the DevOps Diaries podcast. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, it was great
talking to you really about Amazon and your experience, and hopefully for the listeners out there that you've learned something either from the technical perspective or if you are in those kind of groups championing diversity or something else, that you've learned something from Laurel's experience too. Laurel, is there any final pearl of wisdom that you want to leave with the listeners?
Don't give up on anything. I think, like I said, my journey has been all over the map. So it's okay if you don't follow a straight line. Just go towards what you're passionate about and just continue to grow.
Awesome. There you have it. Folks, thank you so much for listening to DevOps Diaries. I hope you have enjoyed the episode. If you have enjoyed the episode, be sure to like, subscribe in the place that you might be listening to. That is the best thing that you can do for us at the podcast here at Gearset to continue producing amazing episodes like this. Laurel, thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it.